Well, let's turn to that passage, the New Testament passage that was just read to us, Hebrews chapter 2. We're looking just leading up to Christmas, just having a quick look at the opening two chapters of the letter to the Hebrews to give us a fresh kind of perspective on the Christmas story. And we're in Hebrews chapter 2. Overheard in a supermarket somewhere were these words: "I love the human race. All of my family belong to it, and some of my husband's family too." I don't know if you love the human race. I hope you do. By the way, there is only one race, and that is the human race, and anyone who thinks otherwise is a racist. But what does it mean to belong to the human race? What does it mean to be a human being? The Bible insists that the answer to that question is to be found in the incarnation of Jesus. That's why it could well be argued that Christianity, properly understood, is true humanism, as opposed to the mysticism of other religions. Someone once said, "I would rather be found in Christ than lost in God." You see, Christianity is not about being lost in God. That's mysticism. It's about being found in Christ, discovering who you really are, finding your true identity as a human being in Him. The first Secretary General of the United Nations, who was a Norwegian, whose name I cannot pronounce, I've got it written down, but I still can't pronounce it, so I won't try. But he said this. He said that he became a Christian in order to become a man. He became a Christian in order to become a man. Well, I think that's really what this passage is teaching us this morning. If you want to know what it means to be a human being, then that's what this passage is all about. So let's have a look at it. I think there are two huge ideas here that I want to kind of tease out of the passage. They're pretty obvious. The first thing I want to talk about is man becoming God. That's a disaster, of course. That's our problem as a race. That's what's gone wrong. Man becoming God. But then, of course, and this is the great message of Christmas, I want us to concentrate and focus on this morning, God becoming man. Because that's the answer to our problem, isn't it? So let's look at those two things, man becoming God and God becoming man. First of all, man becoming God. Look at verses 6 to 8. What is man? He's quoting from Psalm 8. What is man that you're mindful of him? And the psalmist is asking the very same question that we're asking this morning. What does it mean to be human? And of course, there have been many answers to that question over the years, ranging from the profound to the ridiculous. Plato once defined man as a featherless biped. And one day one of his students turned up in class with a plucked chicken and held it up and announced to the class, "Behold, Plato's man." That's funny, you know, you should be laughing at that. I was speaking yesterday at Kapira Sanctuary and I made that remark and everybody was falling around laughing. I don't know what's wrong with you lot. Much too formal. It encourages me when you laugh at my funny remarks. I mean, is that all we are as human beings, you know? Plucked chickens. Naked apes, as Desmond Morris or David Attenborough would tell us. Someone once, with too much time on their hands, once worked out that the average human being has enough fat for 7 bars of soap, enough iron for 1 medium-sized nail, enough phosphorus to tip 2,200 matches, enough potash to explode a toy crane, and enough sulfur to rid one dog of fleas. That's what we are chemically. And if that's all that you are, then you're only worth a couple of dollars. You're only worth the price of a cheap chemistry set. If that's all that you are, you're of no more value than a chook or a dog. And yet, isn't it interesting, even someone like Peter Singer, given the choice, if he had to make the choice, would probably rather run over a dog than a child. Even the most convinced atheist faced with that sort of situation, would make that choice. So what is man? Are we just a highly developed animal, as Darwin thought, or an underdeveloped child, as Freud believed, or simply a cog in the machine, an economic unit, as Karl Marx believed? What is man? There have been so many answers to that question. Mark Twain once apologized for the human race by explaining that God made man at the end of a very busy week when he was tired. What is man? What does it mean to be human? What does the Bible say? Look at verse 7. Look what it says there from that psalm. You made them a little lower than the angels. You crowned them with glory and honor and put everything under their feet. When God made us, when God created the human race, it was to rule the world under him. And he gave us the authority to care for the earth, to cultivate and to nurture it. That means that it's our responsibility to seek peace and justice and prosperity. To care for the environment, to make it flourish, to explore it and not to exploit it. That was God's original intention. But look what it says there in verse 8. It's not what we see. It's not our experience of life in this world, is it? We don't see everything subject to them, to human beings. As Martin Luther King said back in the days of the Cold War, we have guided missiles but unguided men. We have the technology to walk on the moon and land on Mars, but we can't live together on planet Earth. We have the scientific know-how to feed the world many times over, and still a quarter of the population is starving. Clearly something is wrong, badly wrong. We can't even rule ourselves, let alone rule the world. Can we? If I ruled the world, it would be a disaster. I can't even organize my own diary. I can't even control my own lusts. It's obvious, isn't it, that mankind doesn't know how to rule the world. Something has gone wrong. And the Bible tells us what's gone wrong. We have usurped the place of God. Instead of ruling the world under his authority, we've tried to take his place. We've snatched at what doesn't belong to us. We've become gods in our own right, knowing good and evil. And that's brought death into the world. Remember in Genesis chapter 3 what God says? In verse 22, after Adam and Eve had rebelled against him, God says, man has now become like one of us, knowing good and evil. You see, it's God's prerogative to determine what is good and what is evil. It is God's prerogative to say what is right and what is wrong. But now human beings have taken that to themselves, and we make up the rules. That's the problem with the human race. It's not that we break God's rules. We think that we can make them up for ourselves. We become like God, determining what is good and what is evil. Instead of ruling the world under his authority, we've reached out and we've snatched at something that doesn't belong to us. My friends, this Christmas, I want to say to you, don't put your trust in human nature, will you? Man becoming God, the master of his own destiny, the captain of his own fate, is an unmitigated disaster. It's exactly what's gone wrong with us. It's led to untold misery and suffering. It's brought death into the world. Man becoming God. So, you know, the sort of things that people say, it really, really irritates. I get irritated very easily, especially when it's too hot. And it really irritates me at Christmas when something happens, you know, in the world, and then people come on and they say, oh, that's restored my faith in human nature. What a load of rubbish that is. Don't put your trust in human nature. The heart of man is desperately corrupt and deceitful above all things. Don't put your trust in the human race. Man doesn't have it within himself to make a better world. We should know that by now, shouldn't we? After all these centuries, in the 21st century, we should know that by now. Mankind doesn't have it within himself to make a better world. Man will not live forevermore because of Christmas Day. What a load of rubbish that is. What a load of sentimental claptrap they sing out there in King George Square, don't they? We're not going to live forevermore because of a date on a calendar. We comfort ourselves so easily, don't we, with sentimental nonsense. We are desperately in need as a race. We don't have it within ourselves to pull ourselves up by our own bootlaces. We can't do it. We should know that by now. As the hymn says, salvation from a higher source flows to the human race. That's what's needed. We can't save ourselves. Salvation from a higher source must come to the human race. And that's the message of Christmas, isn't it? Look at verse 9. But we do see Jesus, for a little while made lower than the angels, now crowned with glory and honor. You see, Jesus is not the man who became God. That's Adam. Jesus is the God who became man. It's not robbery for him to claim equality with God. We saw that last Sunday morning, didn't we, when we were in Hebrews chapter 1. He is the divine majesty. Angels are on his majesty's service. But he is the divine majesty. Remember, we saw that last Sunday morning. He is the radiance of God's glory. He is the express representation of God's character. That's who he is. It's not robbery for him to snatch at equality with God. He didn't reach out and grasp at something that didn't belong to him as Adam did, as we have all done in Adam. He humbled himself. For a little while, the psalm says, he was made lower than the angels. And there are these three powerful pictures here which unlock for us the meaning of Christmas. Three wonderful ways in which Jesus has humbled himself to become our Savior. Let me just show you that from the passage. First one is this: he is the pioneer of our salvation. He is the trailblazer, literally. That's what it says there in verse 10. The pioneer, the trailblazer of our salvation. Sir Edmund Hillary was the first man to climb Everest. He was a pioneer. No one had ever been up Everest before. He goes first. He works out the route. And he's opened the way now for everyone else, and now it's doable. It's more than doable, in fact, isn't it? There's such heavy flow, such a heavy traffic flow on Mount Everest these days that there's a litter problem. Nearly, 200 tons of rubbish are scattered on the trail to the summit. And it's all Sir Edmund Hillary's fault, because he was the first one to open up that trail. And here's the point, you see. Jesus is not, as it were, sort of up there on the summit, peering down at us from a great height. He's not a detached observer of the human condition. He is the pioneer of our salvation. He is the trailblazer. That's why he has come into the world. He's come into this world, as it were, to open up the way for us to be saved. Look what it says. It talks about him bringing many sons to glory. He's opened the way for us. He's, as C.S. Lewis puts it, he's blown a hole through the back of death. Our great captain has opened a cleft in the pitiless walls of the world and bids us come through, says C.S. Lewis. If you're a Christian, if you're a follower of Jesus, then you're going to glory. Do you understand that this morning? I know we use that phrase. It's a cliche, isn't it? You know, someone we know, someone we love has died, and we say, well, she's gone to glory. What does that mean? I mean, what picture do you have in your mind when you say that? You and I, if we are Christians, if we are followers of Jesus, he's the trailblazer, he's the pioneer, he's leading us. Where is he leading us to? To glory. What does that mean? We often think of it as some kind of nebulous state, the other side of the grave. We're not quite sure how to describe it. Let me show you what it means. Look at verse 5. It's the world to come. That's what we're talking about, he says there in verse 5. The world to come with everything under your feet. That's glory. It's not sitting on a cloud twanging a harp like a ghost. Glory is the world to come with the factory settings restored. Glory is you and I as human beings once again, as God intended us to be, ruling over the universe under his authority. That's why Jesus came into the world, to bring many sons to glory. And how does he do that? By becoming one of us. Do you see that here? Look at verse 11. He enters into the human family, doesn't he? He becomes our big brother. Look at verse 11. He's not ashamed to call us brothers. Our Western individualistic society is so different to the world of the New Testament. Nowadays, if you go for a job, you need a resume, you need a CV, and you talk yourself up, don't you? And you list your accomplishments and your achievements and your exam results. And other cultures do it differently. Other cultures are more realistic. They understand that you came to be the person that you are today, not so much by your exam results and the school you went to and your achievements and your accomplishments, but by your family, the family that you belong to. You are the product not so much of your own choices and decisions, you're the product of your family. And so in ancient times, if you wanted to recommend yourself, you didn't write a resume or get someone to write a resume for you or a CV. You gave your genealogy, your family tree. And isn't it interesting that page one of the New Testament opens with what? A genealogy. The genealogy of Jesus. Matthew chapter 1. Page 1 of the New Testament. Matthew, a book that's written to recommend Jesus to us. How does it begin? It begins with a list of names, unpronounceable names. It begins with a genealogy, with a family tree of Jesus. And how stunning is that? You see, if you're writing your family tree up in the ancient world, you wouldn't mention the black sheep in the family. You wouldn't mention those family members that you were perhaps a little bit embarrassed about, you know, the ones that come around at Christmas time. You'd put the high achievers on the list, wouldn't you, and the famous ones right at the very top of the tree. So how stunning is it when you come into the New Testament and to the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew chapter 1, and look who's there. There are women there for a start, and I hate to say this because it's a scandalous it's an awful thing to say, but in the Roman world, women were never included in genealogies. And in many cultures, the same would be so today. It's Christianity that's liberated women and given them their proper place. But in the ancient world, that wasn't the case. And yet in the genealogy of Jesus, what do you find? You find women. Tamar. Bathsheba, Rahab, Mary. And of course, if you know your Bible, you know these women. There's stories connected with all these women. Look who they are. One of the most sordid stories in the Bible is the story of Tamar. It's definitely R-rated. I won't even tell you where to find it, so you can't go and look it up. It is a most sordid, sordid episode. Story of incest. Bathsheba. David committed adultery with Bathsheba, but it takes two to tango. Story of adultery. Rahab. She was the prostitute. She's there in the genealogy of Jesus. Great-grandmother of King David. Rahab, the prostitute. And Mary. Don't be fooled by the lovely Christmas cards with the blue dress and the hair. Mary was a young unmarried woman, a teenage peasant girl from Galilee. She was a scandal in her village. The marginalized, the excluded by the moral standards of the day. But Jesus proudly puts them in his genealogy. Do you see? He's not ashamed of us. He's not ashamed to call us sinners that we are, compromised in so many ways, flawed, fallen sinners. He's not ashamed to enter into our family, the family of the human race, and call us brothers, sisters. He for whom it is not robbery to claim equality with God has entered into a fully authentic human existence. He's entered into the human family, and he's not ashamed to call us his brothers and sisters. He's our big brother, and he'll do what big brothers do. He will protect us from the schoolyard bully. Do you see that there in verse 14? I mean, if your big brother is the king of the universe, that has to be a distinct advantage, don't you think? And that's who he is. But look what he says there in verse 14. Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death. That is the devil, the big bully. And set free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Isn't that true? Death is the taboo subject, isn't it? It's the subject you don't talk about at dinner parties. One hospital I heard of in the States, rather than talk about death, talked about negative patient output. Death. But when I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil if I'm a follower of Jesus. When I walk through the valley, and we all will have to, when I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. Why? Because he has taken the sting out of death. What is the sting of death? It's sin. And Jesus has come into the human race and taken a human body so that in that body he might bleed and die. Take the punishment of my sin, dying in my place. When I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because my big brother has beaten the bully. He's taken the ground from under his feet. When I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Why? Because he will be with me. My big brother will be with me. Not some powerful angel who will frighten the living daylights out of me. But Jesus, who's not ashamed to call me brother, he will be with me at that moment when I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. So he's the pioneer of our salvation, the trailblazer to open the way for us to bring many sons to glory. And he's our big brother to beat up the bully who has terrorized the human race for so long. For so long we've been haunted by the fear of death. And he's our king and our rescuer, isn't he? Look at verse 10 again. He's crowned with glory and honor, we're told there in verse 5. Crowned with glory and honor. Verse, we're told, we see Jesus now crowned with glory and honor. And verse 10 says, in bringing many sons to glory, it was fitting that God, for whom and through whom everything exists, should make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through what he suffered. What does that mean? Wasn't Jesus always perfect? How is it that God had to make him perfect through suffering? Well, surely what it means is simply this, that Jesus... Let me put it like this. Imagine a person trapped in a burning building. You don't send in someone wearing Speedos to rescue them, do you? That would not be fitting. That rescuer would not be perfectly suited for that situation, would he? All right, if he's a lifesaver at Bondi, that would be a different matter. Then he would be perfectly suited for that rescue. Or, on the other hand, if someone is drowning at sea, you don't send someone dressed up in the heavy-duty clothing of a fireman to dive into the water, do you? That would not be fitting. That rescuer would not be perfectly suited for that kind of a rescue. Do you see the point? The type of rescue defines the type of rescuer that we need. And we need a man to rescue us. The man of Psalm 8. The proper man, as Martin Luther calls him. Not Superman. We don't need Superman. We need a man like us who's faced temptation as we have. Who's coming into this world and taken upon himself human nature in its low condition. And he was tired. And he was betrayed. And he needed friends. A man like us. God has made him perfectly suited to be our rescuer through the things that he suffered. Jesus exactly suits us sinners. Put that on a Christmas card. That's an acronym of some sort, isn't it? Jesus exactly suits us sinners. He is perfectly qualified to be our rescuer because he's lived the life that we should have lived and we haven't, and he's died the death that we deserve to die in our place. You know the story of Father Damien? I don't know if you know that story. It was made into a major movie. It's a true story. Joseph Damien was a Jesuit missionary in the 19th century who ministered to people with leprosy on the island of Molokai in Hawaii. One morning, as he was getting up, getting ready to go out to lead them in their daily worship, he accidentally spilt some boiling water on his foot. It took him a few moments to realize what had happened because he hadn't felt any sensation. Gripped by the sudden fear of what that might mean, he very bravely poured some more boiling water on the same spot. No feeling whatsoever. As he walked into the church that morning, he got up to open the service in his usual way. Normally he would say, "My fellow believers," but this morning, instead of saying, "My fellow believers," he said, well, you know what he said, don't you? "My fellow lepers." My fellow lepers. And that's what Jesus has done. The one whom angels worship. He's left his throne in heaven. He's entered into the human race. And he, who is the radiance of God's glory and the express image of God's character, he who knew no sin became sin for us, so that we might be made right with God. How willing was Jesus to die, that we fellow sinners might live the life they could not take away. How willing was Jesus to give. "My fellow sinners," he says. He's not ashamed to call us his brothers and sisters. He's our brother, our captain, our trailblazer, our king. Now, the practical implications of this are awesome. They're enormous. Let me just list a few, very few, as we close. To become a Christian, to become a follower of Jesus, is the biggest thing that can happen to anyone. It's to become real. It's to be made truly human. It's to be remade in the image and likeness of God. It's to be brought back to what God created you to be. It's to be crowned with glory and honor. As Rabbi Duncan said, "Fallen men are dethroned princes. Believers are restored princes." And it means now that you can take control of your life under the lordship of Christ if you become a follower of Jesus, if he's your pioneer, your trailblazer. See, God has given us in Christ sovereignty over the world. We are to exercise dominion. We are to reign in life through this man, Jesus Christ. Whatever you've been given, whatever it is, that quarter of an acre block, your house, your family, your job, it's yours to rule for God. God has entrusted you with these things to manage for him. The environment. You see, we of all people should be environmentalists. I remember when I first became a Christian being absolutely shocked by a very godly old strict Baptist lady. We were driving along in the car and she was eating toffees And she just opened the window and kept throwing the papers out of the window. And it absolutely shocked me because I was very sensitive once I became a Christian that this was God's world that we're living in. Heaven above is deeper blue. Earth beneath is brighter green or something like that. Something lives in every hue. Christless eyes have never seen. If we're Christians, then we suddenly realize this is God's world. It's made for us. It's to be put under our feet. We are to explore it, not exploit it. We are to harness its powers, to probe its mysteries, whether those of remote galaxies or subatomic particles. We are to manage its resources, and we will have to give an account of our stewardship. And it charges our lives with meaning and significance, doesn't it? Death robs life of meaning. And so you spend all your life on some really important research project, and then dementia sets in, and your powers fail. You can be President of the United States in your prime and end up with Alzheimer's. Death mocks us. Death ridicules my life. It says that everything I've lived for and achieved and attempted is just a waste of time. It's ridiculous because in the end I have to die and leave it all behind. But Jesus has destroyed death. He's blown a hole through the back of death. And he is even now bringing through that hole, he's bringing many sons to glory. How good is that? That there's this continuity between this world and the world to come. Nothing will be lost. Everything good will be carried over and sanctified and glorified in the world to come. That's the Christian's hope. Not that we will survive death and live as spirits in some place called heaven. No, we will rule on earth under the sovereignty of God. We will judge angels. He is bringing us right now to glory. So fix your eyes on Jesus. That's my message to you this morning. That's what it says there in verse 1 of chapter 3, doesn't it? Let Jesus be your role model. Let me ask you, men in particular, what is your image of a real man? Or perhaps I should ask the women, what is your image of a real man? The Aussie bloke? You know, with a can of beer in one hand and a Sheila on the other, standing at the bar talking about the footy? Is that a real man? Or the English gentleman, you know, polite, chivalrous, opening doors for the ladies, honest, caring, a real gentleman? Is that your view of the real man? Or maybe it's Renaissance man. The all-rounder, the sportsman and scientist, he fights and reads poetry, he's educated, he's a literary man, he's strong and sensitive. There are so many definitions, aren't there? There are so many role models out there, movie stars, sports personalities. But we see Jesus. He's our role model. He's the real man. He's the proper man. He's the man of Psalm 8. He's the man that we're called to be. Let him be your real model, your role model. Fix your eyes on him. Keep your eyes on him. Let him shape your sense of who you're meant to be. Apparently it was said of one of the Roman emperors that he is not just a king, but a captain and a brother. Not only did he lead his soldiers into battle and fight for them and alongside them, he tore his royal robes in order to bind up their wounds. And our Jesus has done that for us, hasn't he? He's ripped open his own flesh and bared his own soul for us. He is our brother, our captain, and our king. So come, let us adore him.